But who's stepping up to assume the task?
Euro 92, one day at a time, day five. Well, what have we got for you? We've got goals, which is always good. We've got games without goals, which is never good. And we've got Scotland being so Scotland, gloriously, wonderfully, fantastically, outrageously brave. There's Holland being kind of a bit scrappy. And we've got other stuff for you as well. But Germany, well, the Germans always win. Isn't that the way it is? Mick Foley, how are you?
I'm good, Rob. Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, luxuriating in a kind of a mixed day for Jimmy and Joe in Scotland, but I'm sure they could be proud of their nation's efforts. You know, you can't take it away from them. This was a hell of a performance against the Germans.
I feel like they're going to be our main focus today because game two was a nil all draw between the Netherlands and the CIS. We still have stuff to talk about in that game, so let's not leave it there. But what I'm delighted to say is that Colin Sheridan didn't have to focus on that as his main game. Colin Sheridan, how are you?
Good, Rob. I was actually a little bit disappointed that I didn't get CIS. They're actually my initials. And I feel that they're kind of the plucky underdogs who deserve a bit more respect for eking out a result in this game. But I won't obviously spoil it for the listeners. But I'm really impressed with our cousins across the water. I'm looking forward to talking about Scotland, actually.
CIS. Okay. Got to guess. We've got to guess the middle name now.
Ignatius.
So I was going to do Ignatius.
You're wrong. But I'll give you the hint, and then you'll know. My mother was a huge fan of a 1980s tennis idol.
Ivan.
Answers on a postcard. There, wow. Yeah,
very
Ivan.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of appropriate for the CIS.
Yeah. There you go. Yes, indeed. Maybe I'm a spy.
speaking of world affairs, just to set the scene for today's show, Yeltsin gets a warm welcome in the US. President Bush said yesterday that Russian President Boris Yeltsin would be treated as a friend, not an adversary, when he was arriving in Washington. Just to summarize the article as I scroll down here a bit, the main focus of the discussion was a radical reduction of their nuclear arsenal and U.S. efforts to get blessing at Congress level for a $24 billion aid package from the West for Russia. Strange times.
Wow. Well, we know how hard it is to get stuff through Congress. So, you know.
They're probably still trying to get that in, and I think it might be vetoed at this point. A word for Spike Milligan. Spike Milligan, one of the stars of the much-loved Goon Show, got a CBE on this very day in 1992, 74 years of age he was at that point in time. Yeah, there you go.
Can I just...
Surprised he took it?
Absolutely. Can I just ask a question though, Robin? Are you by any chance auditioning for one of those like classic hits radio stations where they read out stuff between the songs?
Did you like my tone there? I'm not doing that every day. I just thought I'd do it because the Russian one seemed relevant. I see your point. Fair point. Move on. That's not what this is about. It's not really in the years. I know where you're going with that. First game of the day, Scotland 0, Germany 2. That doesn't even begin to tell the tale of this particular story. How do we get through this without using the word brave 74 times, Mick?
It's going to be difficult. Like, this was such a resilient performance. I mean, I could imagine... I mean, if Mel Gibson was trying to get in character a couple of years later for Braveheart, you know, kind of yomping around the Curragh of Kildare, he could have done worse than watch a video of this. the Scots were... Like, you know what? No, it's not about being brave, Renton. They played really well. Like, they played really, really well. Whatever they had, they maxed out on what was on the field. The only thing they couldn't do was score a goal, which was an ongoing issue for the Scots in around that time. But, like, defensively, Richard Gough was incredible. Paul McStay in the middle of the field was superb. Stuart McCall was very, very good, I thought. Like, we will go through a lot of these guys anyway, I'm sure, in the conversation, but they were just really, really good. I mean, it finished 2-0. It could just as easy. And that's now, notwithstanding that the Germans hit the post twice. Am I right? Definitely once, if not twice. It could have been, but it could have been. If the Scots had a fox in the box, they would have probably scored 5 goals. It could have been 5-2 very, very easily.
Unreal. 8 shots on target each, Colin. Absolutely. Sometimes when we're, and we've discovered this during the Italian 90, a bigger scale with the amount of games you're watching, but you can genuinely just get really surprised by the narrative and then what you see on a rewatch. Scotland, like 50 minutes into watching that game back, I was like, my God, they're on fire.
Absolutely, Rob. When I was reading about this game before I watched it, I fully expected, when I was reading about the resilience that Mick referenced or whatever, to then watch the game and just see it be an absolute bombardment of the Scottish goals for 45 minutes, and then eventually the resilience is broken down and Germany, you know, become their true selves, etc., etc. So I was greatly, greatly surprised and massively impressed to actually see it was the opposite. That Scotland played really great football, especially in the first half of that game. And even after they conceded and went a second goal down, they kept playing. They still had chances. And it was actually probably the most open game of football, I think, in the tournament to that point. And it just kind of hammers home how, like, I was looking at this beforehand, like, Scotland lost twice, I think, between Italian 90 and Euro 92. The group they went through, I know you probably spoke about this in their opening game, but the group they went through with Switzerland, Romania and Bulgaria, like to get out of that group, to qualify for the tournaments, they were the kind of rank outsiders even when Denmark came into it. And then for all of that, playing against one of the favoured nations, the world champions, you know, Germany after unification, etc., etc. It was an incredibly brave performance, I think, in the way that they played and attacked the game. And they most definitely should have got something out of it. And as Mick said, they could have, if they were a different team playing under different conditions, if they were Germany, for instance, they would have scored 3 or 4 goals. But just the Scots being Scottish, yeah, it just didn't fall for them.
That was it. Like, I mean, you mentioned there, Rob, they had 8 shots on target. They had 17 shots altogether in the game. Like, no, to be fair, the Germans had 15. So, I mean, you know, they were given it plenty. I mean, Thomas Hessler was super in this game. Again, really super down the right-hand side. And that was where the Germans focused their efforts, was down that right flank. It's where they got their second goal. And even in the first 15, 20 minutes, there must have been definitely 3 or 4 low crosses from the right-hand side, from their right-hand side down Scotland's left, that put Scotland in a lot of trouble. So that was where they were going. We're going after poor old Maurice Malpass, possibly because there was no cover in front of him. It was very hard. He didn't seem to have much cover. And funny enough, the Dutch did the same. The Dutch went after the Scottish left as well. So, you know, obviously these teams had spotted a weakness there. But, like, yeah, like, as Colin says, like, I mean, it's, they did so well and they came through such a tough group. It's funny, like, when you're watching, growing up watching English and Scottish football, all these Scottish names are really familiar to you. And I remember, like, when they used to go to these World Cups, you'd go, oh, they're going to do well, you know, because they're really good players, all these guys. And I mean, you know, Gary McAllister was young, you know, Richard Goff, as I say, was brilliant. Max Day was there, Stuart McCall, Davy McPherson, Stuart McKimmy, Malpass, Ali McCoys and Brian McClare. So they're certainly not the quality of Mexico 86, the Scottish squad of that era. Mm. But, like, they have, like, you were fascinated. I was certainly fascinated to see what Paul McStay would look like in this company. Because at the time, like, he had already spent half a lifetime at Celtic. There was actually talk of him going to Italy that summer. I think it might have even been mentioned in the commentary that we were listening to. But I went kind of looking to see what was the team. And the team, I think, that we're looking at him was Udinese in Italy. And, I mean, this was a game, and he was very good against the Dutch as well, but this was another game where he was just sheer class. And in the end of it, he went home. In the end, he went home and signed a big long contract for Celtic and never left. But you just wonder, I would certainly wonder, what the likes of a Paul McStay would have done in Serie A in that era when it was at its peak, you know? I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah, I mean, he seems like an ideal player for, like, what we would have been watching in Channel 4 in the mornings after this tournament, Colin. Like, he would have slotted into a lot of those Italian teams in that kind of playmaking, creative role. Some of his touches, God, he created a chance in the early stages where they took 3 German defenders out. He did, with his the timing of the pass. Like.
Yeah, and again, the beauty of that Scottish team was that he didn't look kind of out of place or that much better than those guys that were around him. And like Mick was saying, I I remember being a young fella and obviously just kind of been a Celtic fan like most of us were, but it was more about the names because you didn't get to see that many games. So like that, just dying to see what this guy was actually like. And even the name, you know, was a very kind of familiar name to us in the Mayo sense or whatever. So it was just his play and even the talk, because like there were so few players obviously from England and Scotland that went abroad at that stage, that when they did, it was obviously an absolutely huge deal. So even the talk of him going to Italy or going to Syria at that point or going to Europe, just elevated him and just put him in a sort of on a higher pedestal than those around him. But still, that team somehow, you know, they played around him. They didn't look out of place around him. The two players that kind of disappointed me in this game were McClare and McCoist. And, you know, I suppose I was a United fan growing up, so I was obviously very familiar with Brian McClare. But I was always, even as a kid watching him, I always found him, like, ageless in the sense that I didn't know whether he was young or old for, like, ages and ages and ages. Never was, like, he always looked like he was, well, actually, yeah, I misspeak there, because he always seemed old to me. And he, I think, looked a little bit old in this tournament. And McCoist, you know, Mick referenced not having a fox in the box. He just didn't give them the kind of focus they needed up front, or certainly somebody like McStay needed to kind of, you know, finish off what they were trying to do. They got more luck out of Gordon Jury, to be honest, than they did out of Ali McCoist in this game. But it's just funny, for as good as McStay was, there was like those around him, like McAllister in spells in that game was like excellent. They were a good team, and like to look at again, it just comes back to the like an 8-team tournament. immediately when you're in that company, you're just playing world-class teams. And I mean, they were so unlucky in this game. And it's not like a patronizing kind of condescending thing to say, because like, okay, if they were bombarded for an hour and then conceded, fair enough. But no, they should have been a couple of goals up in the first half. And they kept going all the way through to the end, which I thought was probably the most admirable characteristic of the performance, was that they, even when they went a couple of goals down, they kept playing and should have scored.
If it's the final word the next day, let me say this: 515 appearances for Celtic from 1981 to 1997. It's a stunning career in one club. Oh God, would we ever see the likes again? Possibly not. 76 caps for Scotland in there as well.
Yeah, exceptional. And he wouldn't have won many league titles compared to other guys who would have played over 500 appearances over 500 appearances for Celtic. When you think how strong Aberdeen were in the first half of his career, and then Rangers obviously coming through later on. He was just a class, just absolute class. And I mean, to go back just to Colin's point about, you know, the danger of being patronising to the Scots, I mean, it's not about that at all. I mean, the reason they didn't win this game is because they didn't have a strike force capable of scoring. Like, as you say, Ali McCoist was a real disappointment in this. Real disappointment.
He was marked out of it, Mick, was he? That's what they said in some of the reports.
I don't know, is he marked out of it? He missed, there was chances that he just butchered, or he just wasn't even in the area he needed to be. Like, McClare was pushed up front with him after a while, and he just wasn't the out-and-out striker they needed. They brought on Pat Nevin in the second half, who was superb when he came on as well. I mean, jinking, and he had, you know, that classic Scottish dribbler, you know, just wonderful. And, you know, he created a few chances. Guys came forward at different times of the game. Stuart McKimmie was very, very quiet. The Hearts defender was very quiet during most of the game, but then he came forward in the last 10, 15 minutes and he shot one volley. He just fizzed over the bar. It was a superb volley. But like, to just go back to, I'm drifting there now. I meant to come back just to the patronising point. Like, so they didn't have a strike force. The first goal they conceded, Karl-Heinz Riedle scored it after about 28 minutes. Now, Scotland had absolutely battered them by this point. But the Germans had given a bit back as well, as I say, with those chances. Klinsmann had already been dangerous. But what happened in that goal, like, Klinsmann got it, held it up with his back to goal, about eight yards out, with Scottish defenders converging on it, but they just could not get the ball off. It was actually classic Kenny Dalglish. He kind of used his arse so brilliantly to hold the defenders off and then just laid it up for Riedler to finish. And that was the quality. The second goal, if you don't mind me jumping forward a little bit, as we said, and I'm talking in terms of why Scotland lost this game. We spoke already about the weakness down there left with Morris Malpass and how Germany just loaded that side. Well, the goal came from down that side as well. It was an attempted cross by Stefan Effenberg early in the second half that Malpass just didn't get close enough to him. I mean, you know, on another day, it would have deflected off of Morris Malpass's shin and gone out for a corner. But on this day, it looped way up in the air, all the way over Andy Gorham's head and into the far corner, off the butt of the post, mind you. So, like, even the idea that maybe Gorham could have saved, I don't think Gorham could have saved it. It was just the way, it was just the way the ball was spinning over him. But my point would be that with a better left back, Germany wouldn't have got at them in the first place down that flank, and possibly that cross wouldn't have even got in there. But look, these are the tiny, tiny weaknesses. Think about it, like, they played the European champions in their first game and the world champions in their second game, and they can consider themselves extremely unlucky to be gone out of the tournament after two games.
We interrupt this show to say we've got a special offer for some of our listeners, many of whom we know are coaches and sports science enthusiasts. For a limited time, those of you who are interested get a 40% discount off the price of DD Sports Science membership when you sign up to using the special code for Euro92. That code is all capital letters DEELY40, DEELY, and the number 40. And that's your coupon code. Now, more on that on our social media pages, but you sign up using that special code. DD Sports Science is an online CPD service for coaches and sports scientists and a big supporter of One Day at a Time shows such as Euro 92. Thanks to Kieran and all the team. I hope you guys can avail of this offer.
Germany didn't impress me in the first game, Colin, but they impressed me here in the midst of all this talking about Scotland. There was parts of the way they played that was like, okay, I'm starting to see, even without Mateus and some other key players, there's a quality team.
Yeah, and you know, the way the Scots opened in that game must have been kind of pretty unsettling to them, but they didn't seem fazed. You know, they didn't seem fazed, and like they gave it's great to see kind of Klinsmann at that time how he played, and he did a bit of everything for them. You know, he was brilliant at holding the ball up. The goal was an absolutely brilliant example, as Mick said, like the way his body positioning in that goal. The way he was nearly angling, you know, as if he was like feigning that he was going to turn and shoot, and just left the ball for Riedler to hit. There's a couple of instances of like running at the Scottish defence hard on the right hand side, coming into the box and cutting the ball back. He was doing a bit of everything for them, and they just had a real attacking flair about them, to be honest, that I didn't remember of them from that time, or even in World Cup 90 as much. But in this game, they really had it, and like the Riedler was all over the place. He did a couple of brilliant moments in the game as well. But they just had such quality footballers all over the park that it didn't faze them the way the Scottish opened at them or went at them early. And as Mick, I think, said earlier on, like Hassler in this game was he was superb. He was absolutely superb. He was everywhere. He did a few great efforts. And, you know, it has to be kind of said that Gorham made some brilliant saves. A couple of them, you could put it down to maybe a bit of luck and that they were point blank or whatever. But of the chances, as the game wore on, at least of the more clear cut chances, definitely fell to Germany. And that was just them from them being absolutely kind of incessant in the attack. But I mean, such a quality team, like Moller, Effenberg, obviously Sammer, like they just had quality all over the pitch, and they were a little bit all over the place at the back, especially from at different times, like an aerial threat into the box. And that seems like a bit of a cliche thing to say, but again, this wasn't like hoofing it forward from Scotland, but like well-worked moves and balls coming in and good knockdowns again from Jury. But even just to kind of see the imagery of Kohler, who just like looked like the quintessential stopper, you know, the German stopper, you know, he just had the chain, and he just always looked like he was emerging from a nightclub like at 3 a.m. you know, with bleary eyed or whatever. He just always looked absolutely wrecked, but he was just such a quality footballer as well. And just kind of surprised me how good they were to watch in this game, because they weren't as German as I remembered them, certainly in 1990.
That's the thing. Like, you know, we've become, because we watched the entire Italian 90 program and we've been watching, we've come a good way along now into Euro 92. You become conditioned to a certain pace in these international games from the early 90s, and a certain, there's a lot of space in them, mm-hmm. and they're quite slow.
The next game's going to show that as well, yeah.
And yeah, and scoring goals is really difficult. The way teams have set up with the back pass and the offside rule, again, the next game is going to really show, is absolutely crippling the game. But this game is like something else. The pace of the game, the speed at which they just flake at each other. Like you mentioned Hessler there, and Andy Moller had a shot, right? And this occurred maybe 5 or 6 minutes after Germany had their second goal. So in early 90s sort of fashion, you would probably shut down and just slow the game to crawl. But the Germans did not, because the Scots did not. The Scots flew at them even harder when they went down 2-0. But at one point, Scotland had one of their many just absolute gimme chances. Brian McClare had a headed chance, and Gary McAllister had a free kick, and oh, jeez. And anyway, the Germans counterattack, and it's Hessler coming forward, and he's flying. And the only thing, if people are trying to get a mental image, the only thing I can think of is the end of the Carlos Alberto goal at Brazil 1970 World Cup final, where the ball is rolled into Carlos Alberto's path, and he just appears, and he drills it into the far corner. Well, Andy Moller almost did the same thing. It's rolled by Hessler into his path, and he hits it like an Exocet missile. But it hits the butt of the post, I think, and it comes back out again. Mm. And it's like, Jesus, this game is just unreal. It's unreal. And when you think, like, the Germans, I did a quick toss, right, when I was watching the game. Like, of the team that started against Scotland compared to the team that won the World Cup, the first 11, like, there are 5 new players in this team. Matthias Sammer, Stefan Effenberg, Binz the Sweeper, Karl-Heinz Riedle, and Andy Moller are all starting where they didn't start in the World Cup final. So there's change coming. Colin is absolutely right about the defence as well. Like, remember the last day in the CIS game? Wasn't it Stefan Reuter gave away a really stupid penalty? He doesn't start this game. But like, really? they end up with Guido Buchwald being carried off concussed.
Yeah.
Because there's so much aerial action. They're down to 10 men. Like, there's lads going, and there was another player as well. I just can't remember who was it. There was another player who was carried off with a towel around his head as well.
Riedler broke his nose.
Stefan Reuter. Stefan Reuter came on. And he had a clash with Stuart McCall and went straight off again.
Yeah.
So, like, they were... And the mention of the headed stuff, like, Richard Goff was like a playmaker. Every single set piece, Richard Goff. Yeah. He had an amazing... Did you notice this? He had amazing hang time. That guy could get up. And 10 minutes could pass and he'd still be up there. It was amazing because he could just...
The hair.
It could have been. I think the mullet was a load-bearing element in this. It's kind of like having... Do you know the way having a strong core is meant to keep you up in the air like that?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was... Yeah. I think having a strong mullet at that time, most of
It's like the Roadrunner cartoons where they're like, they go off the edge of the cliff and for a second they suspend in the air. That's what he did. Just like, I'm just sitting here, just thinking. Here, I've conflicting feelings about this. Look, we're going to circle back to a little game before we finish this contest, because I open on the Daily Record on the player rating section, and I already feel like you're going to both do well in this, because I like your assessment. You're in line with it at the time. But let's not go over there for a second. Let's instead go to the back page, where on the back page of the... that said Daily Record. This is interesting, because at first I was like, oh, that's pathetic. But an emotional Andy Roxburgh broke down in tears last night as Scotland crashed out of the European Championships. It was another choker as Roxburgh and the Scotland players left their dressing room twice to salute the Tartan Army, who refused to leave the ground, as was their wont in those days, I should add. But the tears... The emotion of Roxburgh. I mean, we were kind of laughing at his inspirational video the last day. Maybe it did work one game later. But like, what do you make of that? Is it almost understandable? Was this an exceptional moment, or was it a bit much emotion from Roxburgh? Let's take that. Mick.
No, I don't think so. I mean, if we go back to my favourite sports doc and Rob's favourite sports doc, The Squad, the story of Scotland in Euro 92, you see the context a bit more. So, like, they've lost the game and they're obviously disappointed. But as you say, like, the crowd is outside in the pen and they're calling for... I think the team had to go three times. And in the end, they were calling for Andy! Andy! Get out here, Andy! And Roxburgh goes up and he says in the voiceover in The Squad, obviously this is after the event, and he said, oh, I really didn't want to go out and I didn't know what to say, you know? So he goes out, and he goes out in fairness to him. And as you say, as we know from his motivational talk the last day, giving those blood curdling kind of speeches wouldn't be his thing. But he went out and he was kind of, you know, kind of making a few jokes about, you know, I'll probably get the sack in the morning, and the crowd like, oh no, Andy, oh no. And it goes on, and he's, you know, he's saying, hope you think it was worth, hope you feel it was worth it coming over. And they're like, ah, my God, it was great. And they're all giving it all that, you know. And but there's a great line, at the end that I'd say they all went home just scratching their heads. He goes, you know, Bertie Vokes, the German manager, great mate of mine, you know, he asked me, will we beat the CIS for us? Will you beat the CIS for us? And Roxburgh's reply was, no, we'll beat them for us. And the boys go, but I'd say they probably were going out like going, where's the next bar going? How does Andy Roxburgh know Bertie Vokes? What's the story there? You know, what kind of circles is this fella moving in? But to be fair to him, you know what? Like, I was doing a lot of the slagging of that motivation video, and to be like, you know, it was fierce funny, but like, he got them right. He like the vibe going into this game when you look at the documentary. And again, it's like they only had a tiny bit of footage, and it's not very good. But you got the sense that it was, lads, just go out and do yourselves justice. Don't be afraid. Just go out and show what you're all about, you know, and that you deserve to be here, and don't be afraid, you know. And in fairness, that's exactly what they did. And I think what's interesting about it, I know what you guys think of this, but I think in the context of how England were going the day before against France and the sterility, and in fairness, I know we've spoken about the weaknesses in the England squad injury-wise, and there was only so much they could do at what they had. But the Scots were true to themselves, you know, in a way that perhaps the English aren't being true to themselves in this tournament. Maybe they are. I mean, they're a long ball team in this tournament.
Well, first of all, I just might say about the Roxburgh inspirational stuff. I think if we look at it through the prism of what we now know about sort of contrived dressing room sweeping, you know, like clips put together by social media teams and put out, or, you know, I think when you look through that prism, it can be a little bit, you know, kind of icky or whatever you might want to say. But I think when you read, or if you guys have done watched the movie of the Scottish journey and read of the journey they went on in the lead up to this tournament, and I think didn't they go through a North American tour before the tournament and all the rest of it, and what their expectations were going into it, and how seriously they actually took themselves while others mightn't have been doing it. I kind of think the Roxburgh thing, and also the fact that it was pretty, you know, too many times you see guys go out and they deliver the Braveheart speech and you're kind of like, they were ready for that. And clearly Roxburgh was not ready for it. And he was kind of stumbling and mumbling through it a little bit, which I think only kind of hints that it was pretty genuine. So I think that side of it, I liked it because I think they were a very likable team. And also I think the fact that they went into that tournament, okay, maybe they didn't see themselves winning it, but they certainly thought enough of themselves that they actually, as Mick said, stayed true to themselves in what style of football they wanted to play, and they gave it a right go.
Just to add to what you said there, Mick, Mike Langley in the Daily Mirror was writing about, you know, Roxburgh's brave army and talking about the fans, but then like four paragraphs in goes, it is unfair, however, for us English to jibe when their team looks better than Graham Taylor's, more cohesive, confident, and fervent. Also, less paranoid and not always looking for excuses. Ooh. And England hadn't even played their final game there.
That's it, though. I mean, that's it. I mean, I in fairness, you know, again, we had a bit of fun about Andy Roxburgh the last day, but I mean, he's done a superb job. He really, really has. And I mean, he stays on. They don't qualify for the 1994 World Cup, and
it goes wrong.
But I mean, doesn't matter. This is like this game. This game that we're focusing on, I mean, hope I have a good, I'm glad to say I've got a good feeling that it's not going to be the best game of the tournament. But it's already, right now, it's the best game of the last two major tournaments that we've watched. Right?
And here's the thing. Do you take this? Like, you know, the point is as well, like I said, it goes wrong then. But the point is, like, Scotland aren't a monster nation in world football. They're a good nation and they punch above their weight. But, like, did it really go wrong? Or did they, like, you know, it was just a case of just team, you know, sometimes we just don't accept that teams have their ups and they have their downs. And also, you know, it's worth celebrating from their perspective when they look back at this tournament. They've had some pretty bad tournaments in their times. This one is not really looking like one of the worst, that's for sure.
No, far from it. And again, I think if you look at the company they keep in the tournament, the size of the tournament, the teams that are around them, the group they got, their results over the three games, you could argue that this is probably, I know 78 was iconic for different reasons. How did 78 actually turn out for them?
They didn't qualify as a group. They got the win against Holland, but it wasn't enough on goal difference. I think that's how I remember.
That was it. It was the famous Archie Gemmell goal, you know?
Yeah, Archie Gemmell. Yeah. Immortalized in Trainspotting. But we'll cover that in the movie.
the movie cast.
Yeah. But it is that thing of like who they had to play. And again, without giving away, you know, spoiler alert or whatever, but like their results over the three games that they played in this and their performances, that's what surprised me, honestly. It's like, you know, when I looked at the game I was watching and or going to watch or whatever, I had certain expectations, especially after reading. I was like, oh yeah, plucky Scots, blah, 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 blah. But no, and just to as you said, the juxtaposition between themselves and England was kind of striking because they were united to the last. They were, and they were true to themselves and they played well. So
just to finish this game, here's a little game for you guys. I want you... this is fingers on buzzers, first of all, in the first two questions. The first man in to shout. One player was given 5 stars out of 5 in the daily record. Come on, quick. You got to get this.
Max Day.
No. It's open to Colin.
It had to be...
Yes.
Goff.
No captain could have tried harder. Yeah, 5 stars.
Well earned.
Yeah. Only one player was given 2 stars. Just 2 measly stars. Who was that?
Well, I would possibly say it's a part of a player. Probably Maurice Malpass's shin.
actually, I'm going to just...
Ali McCoy.
Yes, Colin, it's 2-0 here.
I'm not looking at them, by the way. But I mean, I would have given McCoy one.
He was terrible.
Anyway,
he was terrible.
Maurice Malpass got 3 stars. God, he did well to get them. Andy Gorham only got 3 as well. I don't know if you could blame Gorham for second goal.
No, are we not meant to be guessing these?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, don't mind that. Here we go, back off. There are a total of 3 players who had 4 stars. Each of you get a point for everyone to get.
Jesus.
4 out of 5. Who were the 4 out of 5s? I think it was...
Stuart McCall. Max Day. Oh, Christ, I'm really bad at this.
McStay, you're right. Jump in there, Colin. You're going to lose points.
McStay, McPherson.
McPherson gets your point.
And
McKimmy.
Yeah.
No, McKimmy only got 3.
Yes,
McAllister, Colin.
Surely.
Colin is stormed to victory in this game.
It's a rout.
McAllister looked pretty composed the whole
Everyone
way through.
Everyone else was 3 stars. Even Pat Nevin only got the 3 stars. Actually, Pat Nevin writes in his book that he was injured during that whole tournament. He didn't tell.
Yeah, so Pat Nevin, who was, as Mick said earlier, who was excellent when he came on against Germany, he picked up an injury on a tour of North America, like just before the tournament. They went to North America to for a kind of a team bonding 2-game tour where they played the US and Canada. And Nevin scored in one of the games, I think, but he picked up an injury, which was a great shame because obviously a fully fit Pat Nevin in a tournament like Sweden 92 would have been just another string to the bow.
Yeah, and it is amazing to think that they didn't actually, he knew that he couldn't run or sprint at full pelt, but yet like his impact and his cameo there was remarkable. That's it for this game. Final thoughts on it, anything else, Dad?
Yeah, just one question for you. What do you, like, if you were sitting at home after watching that game, right, and you've seen the Germans now twice in the tournament, where would you put them? Would you say they're going to win this thing, or is that defensive thing a little bit little bit of a worry for them? Or are they just so good going forward? It's like, this is a cool Germany.
It's a good question, because we kind of know. So then you might say one thing or the other. But Colin, I'll let you jump in on this. But it's just, you know, they struggled through a draw I think in the first game, and then they were carved open by Scotland. So I'm sure the mood wasn't very high on them.
Yeah, but I think it was, and I think I remember this as a kid, that I was excited by Germany in 92. I think probably it was the, you know, unified Germany, the jersey, maybe, you know, but, or maybe it was just being a little bit older and more aware of like who the players were or whatever. But I do actually remember kind of liking that team. So to kind of give the academic answer of what I think now after seeing more of the teams play, you'd still fancy them. I mean, you'd still fancy them, given that you can't trust. You could never trust an England team, obviously, and then like Netherlands. Okay, I don't know. Maybe that's not really a definitive answer. I still like it.
I like it.
Not knowing nothing, I tipped them to get as far as the final.
You can never never talk to Germans. Never talk to Germans, lads. Yeah. The one more thing. Sorry, Rob. I nearly forgot. The stadium in Norrköping.
Oh yeah.
Like less than 20,000 people in there. It was rocking.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely rocking. The atmosphere was brilliant. Like, these games are tricky to find, but I would say, I know no one's going to do this, but if you did have 90 minutes and you were kind of looking out going, I want to do something pointless, go find this match and watch it. It's such great fun.
Yeah, this is the one actually so far that I'd say all the others you can skip, but this one, the rest of you go and do what Billy Joe wanted to do, which is watch World Cup 82 and be done with it. But anyways, enough of that. Moving on. Next game is definitely going to lift a mood. Not. Netherlands, nil. CIS, nil. Oh my God. Back to Italia 90 we go. But not even back to Italia 90. It was scrappy. It was messy. The touch was off. Everything was, there was energy, but I don't know. Poor game.
Yeah, I mean, some incredibly talented footballers, obviously, on show. And it just goes to show that as much as we can philosophize on these things and cast a cold eye on it and put narratives on it, because certain things make sense to us now, retrospectively, when you have such talented footballers on the field, as were on that field during that game, and for, as you say, it's not like that it's, I mean, it is bad and it becomes like really bad, but it's more scrappy, as you say, than anything else. Like, the will is there for a long time, at least. It fades, as my own will faded. But yeah, it was just one of those games you get in tournaments sometimes. Yeah. I mean, I know there was probably a couple in this tournament, but it was just a kind of a... It was all set up for kind of, you know, that Dutch team to explode and to do something kind of magical like we expected them to do, and it just didn't really happen.
It just didn't.
Mick will tell us why.
Oh, I can't. It's like a black hole of football, this game. It just sucks every possibility of quality. And I mean, it's like what you said, it's not for the want of trying. Like, the Dutch are trying. They are trying. And to be fair, the CIS are trying as well. But there was something about the whole vibe of the game. Like, even when you're watching it on the feed, it comes on, and what we've become slightly accustomed to in this tournament is small grounds with kind of a more intimate camera angle. You're closer to the field, you're closer to the pitch, even though in a lot of them there's a running track around them and stuff, but you feel like you're closer to the field. On this one, it was back to Italia 90, where they had the camera down in the city centre, you know, miles away from the pitch, really high, steep angle. So the pitch looks enormous. And it looks like there's loads of room and fellas are jogging around, tipping about the place. Like, the only time that the game, and this says something, I think, about the rules as well at the time. The only time that I found that the game actually picked up pace was when the Dutch had to pass the ball back to Hans van Breukelen. And he was in a situation where he couldn't pick the ball up for some reason. There was a CIS player coming in on him or something like that. And he had to kick the ball fast. And suddenly, for the next 20 seconds, the whole thing accelerated. Like going from third gear up to fifth gear shot. It was just, you know, there was chaos, and not even chaos, just a bit of uncertainty about it. Like, the Dutch did try, and it was, like, I was reading, I've taken to reading Eamon Dunphy's stuff on the Sundays, you know, the Sunday Independent. And the Sunday after, and to be fair, the third matches have been played by the time he gets to write again. But he is really effusive about the Dutch, that the Dutch are the saviors of football, that this tournament is evolving into a really good one, and the Dutch are in the vanguard of that evolution, away from Italian 90 to a more creative style of play. So it's not that they're not being creative. Like, you could look at this match, nil all, right? But you could look at it and go, oh, geez, Bergkamp. Some of the things that Bergkamp does are, yeah, you know, there's little intimations of what's to come from him.
Yeah.
Like, Van Basten is lethal, just can't get there. And on the other side, like, Kolivanov for the CIS is very energetic and really trying hard up front. Dimitri Karin, our old friend from Chelsea. And later, Celtic, actually. I'd forgotten he was at Celtic because I was curious to see. I tell you what it was. I was curious to see, why does he wear tracksuit pants, right? So I tried to dig out, why does Dimitri Karin wear tracksuit pants? And the best reason that was given was that he had some scar tissue on his knees. And this is why he needed to protect. He needed to protect. This is why he wore tracksuit pants. But I'm not even sure that's right, because he did do his cruciate. He did his cruciate at Chelsea, which finished him there. And he did it again at Celtic. But I mean, he was wearing the pants a long time before that. So I don't know. Maybe if there's anybody out there that knows why Dimitri Karin was wearing them at CSK Moscow, I'm sure loads of people know. It would be good to know. But like, he had a very, very good game. People are trying. People are playing well. But it's just the pace of the game is terrible. There's a couple of nasty tackles. I mean, it kind of said it all, that Van Basten's last meaningful contribution to the game was an absolute leg breaker of a tackle on Oleg Kuznetsov in the CIS box. But there's one other major incident. Like, it's the goal that should have been.
How can any linesman call that offside? Mother of God.
Absolutely insane. Like, just to paint the picture for people, like, it was
tragic.
It was a lovely lofted ball. Lovely lofted ball into the box for Van Basten. Diving header. Terrific goal. Flag goes up. And you're looking at it going, okay, he was ahead of everybody by the time he landed on the ground. So he's going, oh, maybe this isn't one of these marginal, kind of, in VAR terms now, would be like, you know, his left armpit hair was offside or something. But then you looked at the replay from the side on, and like, Dennis Bergkamp and one of the CIS defenders, Sieva, is playing him onside. There's two players playing him onside. It's so blatantly, obviously onside. You're kind of thinking, it's impossible to even explain why and how the linesman came to that decision. Only that it was repetitive stress syndrome in the early 90s to throw your flag up if there was a possibility of a goal being scored. That's about it. Like,
dreadful call.
Summed it up.
Van Basten used straight away. Like,
I agree, and it kind of summed up the whole game. Karin was like, he made two great saves two decent saves from Bergkamp. And at least one from Van Basten as well, with the kind of a back header at one stage.
Yeah.
So he was hugely impressive, and I guess it was shop window stuff for him.
Yes.
It's amazing. It's amazing what, you know, where that, you know, left them. He left them in a position that, you know, beating Scotland, I guess,
guaranteed them. Yeah.
It would have put them through.
Yeah.
It would have put them through. And I mean,
yeah,
Karin, and that actually, it does bear mentioning, that header from Van Basten, Colin, that you mentioned. It was a back header from not really close to goal. It was out kind of to the right hand side of the box. Probably a total of 10 or 11 yards from goal. And he just kind of backheads it. It's a and it loops up and almost over Karin. He just gets his hand to it and steers it around the post. It's a brilliant save, but it's a really brilliant header. So you had these little moments.
Brilliant header, yeah.
Like, Hullet was okay. Rijkaard was in the game. But there's, like, you've got fellas there and you're kind of looking at them going, what are you doing there? Like, Brian Roy has been very unimpressive.
Very unimpressive. And they obviously believed him. Yeah, I believed in him.
Rob Vichka is another one who's not doing it for me. I feel like I'm on the RTE panel. Yeah,
no,
Rob Fisk is
not a
good
plan.
But like,
throw the pen
over Rob Vichka.
Right, that's it from us. Yes, as the lad said, Germany on 3 points, Holland on 3 points, as they were called in the Irish Independent at the time, and the Netherlands, as they should have been referred to, CIS on two, Scotland done and dusted on zero. Surely this CIS going through to the next round. Meanwhile, Mick, the English papers were a little bit more focused on all the chaos that was going on in the England camp. I think even Stuart Pearce was given off about ITV, who were sending videos to UEFA. Grant Jenner was given off about Jimmy Hill and whoever else he wanted to give off about as well. It was just crazy.
Yeah. Mental stuff. We chatted about it on the last episode. They just went totally crazy. Like, he had a press conference the following day after the France game. Or maybe it might even been that night. But anyway, yeah, he went off and won about Jimmy Hill and Des Lynam, and they were going to, as you say, they were sending, what do we call it? It was practically movie reel footage or something like it. It wasn't like we're sending video evidence, you know.
No,
something antiquated.
It's Stuart Pearce and Dicker, as you pointed out in the last podcast. Raging, but even more raging in the interviews in the following day's paper. Yeah, that's it. Colin, you're back on, actually, England's final game. We'll talk to you then. Quality.
He's delighted. He's delighted.
Plus, you're going to see some of Sweden, and you're going to see Denmark against France. And let me just tell you, there's a story about the French just telling the Danes, just go easy on us here, guys. We've got a semi-finals coming. Oh, I'll tell you more about that. Oh, that's a story. That's a story. Right, that's it. Thanks, lads.
Rob.
Oh, Rob.
Thanks a million. Here's Rob.